Hello again, and welcome to What We Just Watched from TV Cream. I'm Ian.
And I'm Chris.
And to kick off this edition, we're going to begin with my choice of programme. Well, okay, I've chosen something that I think, Chris, you'll get within about 0.5 seconds.
Right, well, I look forward to that.
Of me pressing the start button.
Okay. Oh, now this is Call My Bluff. You were right, 0.5 seconds. So we're seeing sort of books stacking up and opening pages.
And that's it. Title sequence is over. Audience of about 10 people clapping. Right, we will now go on a break for the duration of the programme, and we will join you again soon. Well, that was an episode of Call My Bluff, and it was first shown on Monday, the 9th of May in 1983 on BBC Two.
Okay.
Now, first of all, Chris, was that the sort of thing that you would have watched back in 1983?
Possibly. It's kind of, this sounds awfully kind of dismissing it with faint praise, but it's the sort of thing you might have watched if there was nothing else on. But I kind of feel, looking back, that's kind of not the... I don't think that's a legitimate attitude towards it, because I think you gathered, I really enjoyed that.
You did. I could tell from your responses throughout it.
It's quite basic, isn't it?
Well, hello again.
You've just got seven people dueling with words. They're dueling their wits. There's no... There's no pretense, there's no kind of artifice. I'd say there is quite a lot of pretense and artifice.
Yes.
But there's kind of there's no gimmickry. It's literally just people trying to outwit one another with their words. There's nothing else to it.
No. For the purposes of the listeners, let's just run through briefly who was involved.
Yes.
Obviously the presenter, Robert
yes.
Robinson.
Robinson.
In full flow throughout.
Absolutely.
Yes. That's it, isn't it? Ring a bell, get a word, that's what I say.
Now, I'm interested as to whether your image or our collective image of Robert Robinson is has always been of this this person for whom, whenever there's a chance of saying two words, he will always say ten.
Yes.
For my bluff, the electronic version of Liardise to which respectability is lent. By Arthur Marshall.
He gives the impression of being slightly scatty, but in
yes.
fact that's probably
yes.
part of his mannerism,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
What else would he be doing? I mean, Call My Bluff was his main programme, wasn't it, around about
yeah.
this time?
Or? Yeah, he did. Well, so he would have been doing Call My Bluff, Ask the Family.
Of course, yes.
And I think he was on Radio 4.
Oh, he did Start the Week.
Yes. Yep.
All of those, he was playing basically the same role of
yeah.
someone sort of chairing.
Yes.
Not really
yeah.
presenting,
yeah. Yeah.
but chairing an exchange. Here, in this case, it's an exchange of definitions.
Yeah.
He's still enjoying himself.
Yes.
Do you think he's a very... Is he an engaging person? Is he a
I think
warm
he's,
person?
Well, I don't think he's a. I don't think he's necessarily a warm person, but I don't think he's necessarily a cold person. One thing that you kind of notice from Call My Bluff is he's almost a competitor in his own right. He's sort of occasionally chiding the captain.
And it's a jolly term for a Methodist minister.
Well,
an unjolly term.
Rudish.
Rude term. He's not listening anyway.
Well, no, kind of, he likes to get one up on them. It's almost like he's the quiz master, he's the question master, but he's also taking part.
Yes, he's along with probably most of the people on this programme. He's someone who you never see his type on television today.
No, you don't.
Someone who doesn't have any sort of visual.
He's not telegenic in any sense of the
right word. But also, he doesn't really have a voice for television, really.
You have
to listen. When he's speaking, I find myself having to strain to catch everything he says.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because he's one of those people who just sort of was sort of born for television but doesn't have any kind of particular sort of any outright skill that you would say, oh, Robert Robinson, the famous, you know, he's just kind of he's just on television.
Yes.
He's nominally in charge, but he's kind of like a third captain. He's sort of in rivalry with Arthur and Frank.
Well, let's talk about those two. It's Arthur Marshall.
Good evening.
Yes.
Frank Mueller.
Good evening.
They do, both Arthur and Frank, do play different roles, yes, in the sense of they, yeah, are different personalities.
Yeah.
How will you describe those differences?
I don't know. Frank is obviously more from the kind of the comedic background as a scriptwriter. So I think he's cast himself as the sharper one. He's, you know, the kind of the smarter one. Where I think Arthur's role is kind of he's kind of underplay his skill a little.
Arthur wears his intelligence very lightly.
Yes.
Whereas I think Frank sometimes overdoes it a bit.
Down that part, Dorsetish part of the world, they don't call bluebells by the name of bluebells as we do in the decadent southeast. They call them greggles. If you don't believe me, rush to your bookshelves. Chapter 20, Mayor of Casterbridge. Greggles were picked.
There's one bit as well where there's a lull where the other team, where Arthur's team are discussing it, and Frank almost feels the need to jump in,
yes,
with a quip.
Yeah.
And don't forget Palmerston was one of our great English prime ministers.
Arthur's kind of more relaxed. Yes. He's kind of, you know, he's, yes, you know, it's only, you know, his attitude is it's just a parlour game.
Whereas, well, it is, isn't it?
Well, it is, but with Frank is a bit kind of keener.
Do you think there is much competition there, or are they not really that bothered?
It's difficult to just kind of, I think if you need to kind of watch more than one edition to kind of get a sense of how seriously they're really taking it.
Well, I think it was the case that they would record two at the time, and so there was that slight element of the return match, which would give, yeah, the other team a, yeah, chance perhaps to get their own back. Let's talk about the guests,
yes,
on the panels. Let's talk first of all about Arthur's team.
With on my left, Victoria Wood.
Good evening.
And on my right, Tim Brooke-Taylor.
Good evening.
Interesting choices, because at the time, Tim Brooke-Taylor had been around for,
yeah,
a couple of decades,
yes,
almost. Established figure.
Yeah.
Victoria Wood, however,
yeah,
this is comparatively early in her career.
Yes.
She hadn't really done anything on the BBC at this point. She'd just
yeah,
done stuff on ITV.
Yeah.
Who do you think is more comfortable?
It's difficult. I think Victoria Wood is kind of in theory an inspired choice for this show, but she doesn't look quite at home.
Do you think that's reflected in their body language as well?
Yeah. She's kind of sort of cast herself, I think, as the naughty schoolgirl.
Yes.
And the back of the class, you're kind of slouching. At one point, it looks like she's chewing. Kind of chewing on a pencil.
They've all got pencils.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole,
yeah,
thing, we'll talk later, yeah, about how
yeah,
cheap it all is. But they've got these,
yeah,
very cheap coloured pencils. And at one point, the camera cuts her, and she's, not only is she chewing it, but she's stuck it right in her mouth. And her mouth is agape, and she's,
yeah,
slouching,
yeah,
on the desk.
But do you think she's doing that deliberately?
No, I think,
so is that part of her strategy?
Well, think about the way that they have positioned the teams.
Mm.
Victoria is the furthest away from Robert on that side,
yeah,
as if they've put the women on the far end, and they've put the two. I don't know whether that was deliberate or not, but it accentuates the impression that she's kind of the slight, sort of, off to one side, slight sort of naughty child in a way. At times, she's almost a bit aggressive towards the other team.
Victoria, your turn.
Come on. Show me your card.
Right. Oh, I wonder if she's done right.
Which jars a little bit with the tone.
Yeah.
And there's at one point when she mishears something that Frank says. They're talking about cheeses. And Frank makes a joke about blue cheeses being the varicose vein cheese.
Wait, sort of varicose frill cheeses. Is it with a blue vein?
And Victoria takes it literally.
Hard, Gloucester, cheddar, the hard ones.
And there's an awkward silence.
It was a good joke, though.
Well, what about the guests on the other,
yes,
side?
And once again, my team of Angharad Rees.
Good evening.
And on my left, Godfrey Smith.
Good evening.
He's,
yes,
compared,
yeah,
not very, very deliberately, I think, not with comics, but with,
yeah,
in one case, an actor, Angharad Rees,
yes,
who I,
yeah,
think at this point was still best known for Poldark,
yeah,
which had finished a few years,
yeah,
before that.
Yeah.
The other person is journalist Godfrey Smith, who I know nothing about whatsoever, other than...
Oh, come on, Ian, everyone knows who Godfrey Smith is.
Well, that's another point, that none of these people are given any information by Robert at the beginning as to who these people are.
Does that matter?
Well, probably at the time you knew who these people were. Maybe they were familiar faces. Maybe Godfrey was always on Call My Bluff or had been on other panel shows. My Music, maybe.
It's kind of interesting that kind of 50% of the guests are female.
Yes.
And, you know, in recent times we've had kind of an edict at the BBC specifying on a panel show you've got to kind of have at least one woman taking part. I do kind of remember Call My Bluff is kind of, there was always be kind of one sort of fairly sort of respectable actress of the young Harrod Reese, kind of Hannah Gordon kind of, of mould on there.
Another thing that struck me was the absence, I think, of a studio audience.
Yes.
Would you agree with me here?
I don't think there was one. I think it was kind of the sort of Kenny Everett video show kind of style of audience where they kind of sort of dragooned in the kind of the studio crew and production team to kind of applaud at the start and applaud at the end. But in between, there's no audience reaction whatsoever.
There are no shots of an audience. There's not even any suggestion on the part of Robert that an audience is present. And the noise, or the volume of the applause that we hear, is derisory, especially at the end. And it tails off so rapidly at the end. To only about the sound of two or three people clapping. But that's partly because the credits only last about 15 seconds. And then we're out.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's a shame that both the opening credits and the closing credits are so short, because that theme tune is brilliant.
Yes. Well, it only lasts a few bars, and at the end, as if to accentuate how cheap the whole thing is, they just—it's like they just flick a switch and they turn the lights off in the studio. Well, it's their attempt to slightly fade the lights.
I think,
and then suddenly in darkness.
I think we also need to talk about the fact that kind of it is plainly done in one take, isn't it? I think also there's the point where someone's giving a definition which possibly may have a sort of rude undertones, and Tim asks if we can hear them and, you know, cut them out later, and I think
Frank then says, oh, no.
We can't afford cutting this programme. No.
Which then also gives the impression that this is a very tightly budgeted show, tightly run.
I think one of the things that kind of that occurred to me kind of when I was watching it is it is kind of basically radio on the television, isn't it?
There's nothing visual
there at all,
is there?
That could work on the radio.
There's no need to see it.
No.
You could have it on in the background on the television and be doing other things quite happily.
Yeah. I mean, the look of the show as well is kind of...
Well, it looks like... There's nothing that particularly distinguishes the look of the show from anything else. It could be a bits of set that have been reused from something else. It probably is the set of My Music that's just been...
But all the kind of...
The different desks have been wheeled out in front of it.
All the kind of the various paraphernalia of the game, like the envelopes and, you know,
the pencils,
it's
the glasses on the desk.
It's a very municipal show.
Yeah,
isn't
that's
it?
A good word. Well, the colour of the envelopes is that colour that you still see in offices as the sort of default colour of nondescript stationery.
That was ordered
in 1953. Which has been still in the old cupboard,
I was going to say, actually, watching the show, we're in 1983, and there's absolutely, with the possible exception of Victoria Wood's jumper, there's nothing to say in that show that we're in 1983.
No, that's a good point.
We could be in 1953.
Yes, it is timeless in that regard. What about Robert Robinson's bear?
It's a funny term, a scathing term, I think, for a Methodist minister.
It's as much a trademark of the show as his comb-over. I think it performs a number of purposes. It gives the show a bit of structure.
Yeah.
Every time he pings the bell, everyone knows, right, we've moved on to the next thing. But also it plays a crucial role in queuing in.
Yeah.
The revolving set, the boring bit of scenery behind him.
I mean, I would say they are the only two bits of theatre you get in the show. So he pings the bell, and the baton behind him rotates to display the word that's under discussion.
Now, wait a minute, though, because during the course of the programme, there are how many words?
There are eight words.
Eight words, and also the title of the programme.
Yes.
So there are nine different things appear on the baton.
Yeah.
Now, how is that happening?
Well, if you will remember from Ask the Family, there was a gentleman called Eric who Robertson always referred to as being in charge of all the kind of various graphics and illustrations. So I kind of figure that Eric is moonlighting on Call My Bluff behind the Robert, set.
Yes.
And he's quickly placing on and removing the words.
Ah,
as
so
the
it's
show
not,
goes along.
That baton is not a nine-sided baton.
I would like to think it was, but I think the visual evidence suggests there's only four sides to the baton. It is kind of quite beautifully crafted, because the panel with the word on sits flush against the aperture. So it's very pleasing visually.
So there is something that's visually integral to the programme, after all.
I think so.
Just that, but that's the only thing, I think.
I think so, but it's one moment of luxury in the show.
Well, that was an episode of Call My Bluff, my choice. Chris, it's your turn.
Right, here we go.
This, I think, is Sin on Saturday.
It is certainly right? Is Sin on Saturday. Maybe you could just say what we've seen.
It's a picture of, what's his name?
Bernard Falk.
Bernard Falk is illustrating through a series of facial expressions the seven deadly sins.
Well.
Plus an eighth sin.
Right. We've got all the sins on screen now. So we're going to now watch the first ever Sin on Saturday. So we've just watched the first edition of BBC Scotland's Sin on Saturday, broadcast on BBC One on the 7th of August 1982, and a programme, it's fair to say, which is regarded as one of the biggest and most notorious flops of all time.
Yes, that's fair. I had heard of this programme, but only thanks to its appearance on a BBC Two documentary called TV Hell.
Yep.
Which was broadcast back in the early 90s. I knew about it from that. I knew that it had been launched to great fanfare at the time and was supposed to run for a total of eight editions.
Yes, yep.
Covering not just the seven deadly sins, but an extra eighth sin.
Yeah. Okay, the BBC are probably the only broadcasting organisation in the world that would decide to make a programme about the seven deadly sins and commission eight episodes.
Yes. Presented by Bernard Falk, who at the time was best known for what?
He was sort of a roving reporter on Nationwide. I think he was doing stuff for Newsnight. He was on Radio 4 quite a bit.
Had he done Now Get Out of
I
That?
I think he had.
Hello and welcome to the fifth and final programme in our series in which two teams, one from Britain and one from America, compete against the clock to rescue a defecting biochemist.
Yeah.
Okay, because that was what I always remember him most from. So that was as much as I knew about it. I knew that it had failed to make it to its eighth programme.
Well, this is a show that was sort of judged to be so bad that it was axed after just three editions by the fabulously named Aubrey Singer, who was the managing director of BBC Television at the time. So how would you describe it, Ian? It's a sort of late-night topical chat show / comedy review based around the seven deadly sins.
It's one of those formats which is a bit of everything and is very much not the sum of its parts. You can imagine a meeting where they thought, right, we're going to do something on the seven deadly sins. Each programme will take a sin as its theme. And to discuss and explore that theme, we won't just have it live. We'll just make it live, because it is live, isn't it?
Yeah.
We won't just have it live. We will have a studio audience, guests, a band. But within the audience, we'll have a cross-section of people about whom...
Yeah.
Something to do with the sin can be explored.
Yeah.
And all this is thrown together in a studio which is almost entirely in darkness.
Yes.
And everyone's on stage all the time.
Everyone's on show,
And I guess it's aiming for, my assumption, a sort of a feel of a kind of slightly sort of loose, informal, and you don't know what's going to happen.
Absolutely. You can imagine that's in the pitch document. You'll never know what's going to happen. Well, what I'm really keen to find out, Ian, is do you think had you been watching when it first went out, would you have been thinking that that programme was so bad that it would be cancelled after three editions? I mean, was it actually that bad?
From a technical point of view,
it was
a bit shambolic,
yeah.
But it wasn't so bad that it fell apart.
No,
I mean, there are degrees of shambles.
Yes. And sometimes that can be a good thing. Saturday.
Yes, it definitely had an air of spontaneity.
I was going to say, it had an air of unpredictability. The problem was that it was sometimes the unpredictability wasn't the good sort of unpredictability.
No, the problem was that instead of delivering on its promise, which was of, anything could happen, we've got an exciting lineup of guests.
Yeah.
It actually became, within a matter of seconds, evident this is actually going to be very, very boring.
Yeah.
And the problem there starts and ends, I fear, with the presenter.
Well, good evening. And a question. How sinful are you? Congratulations, unless you're being really honest with yourself, you've just committed another one.
Yes, I mean, I don't think he's the right man for the job at all, and I think also the job that he does is quite poor. He's kind of saddled himself with this kind of endless sort of wordy scripts. He takes ages to anyone who comes on as a guest, he takes ages to introduce them.
Let me introduce a policeman's daughter who's now a respectable suburban housewife and mother, but in the 60s starred in dozens of pornographic films, the most famous of which, Deep Throat, is still showing on Broadway.
You forget, the sentences are so long, and you forget how he started them before he got to the end of them.
Also a woman who became a postulate nun at the age of 17 until she was married to Jesus Christ and became a full member of a teaching order at an English convent.
And they contain jokes which just get no reaction from the
studio audience. Set the tone right from the start when they sit in complete silence throughout Bernard's opening monologue.
Most of us can remember the first person, I suppose, we made love to. But as we get older, the problem is trying to remember the last.
No kind of warmth at all. He's got no charm.
Linda Marcio, Linda Marciano, formerly known as Linda Lovelace, and Karen Armstrong.
I think he also exhibits one of the other flaws in the programme, which is that he keeps talking. The programme is nominally about lust, and he keeps endlessly dragging it back to that subject. So when people, let's talk about who the guests are. There's notoriously Oliver Reed. There's a romantic novelist, Charlotte Lamb.
Yes, Mills and Boone. Yeah.
A nun who, as Bernard keeps saying, she's a former nun who climbed over the convent wall to kind of experience lust for herself. And there's Linda Lovelace, who's this kind of very kind of famous at the time former pornographic actress. And so all of these people, in their own individual ways, have kind of interesting things to say about their lives. But they're never given the opportunity to do that, because Bernard keeps saying, so what's your definition of lust? And he kind of keeps dragging it back to this.
All four of them have incredibly interesting lives. And in some cases, quite disturbing stories to tell.
Absolutely.
Which they're quite bravely sharing.
Yeah.
But none of them, not one of them, should be on the programme. Because they do not have anything to say about lust.
No, and that's the issue, because when they start saying interesting things, Linda Lovelace starts talking about kind of the abuse and that she suffered and kind of the conditions that she was forced to endure when she was...
Bernard couldn't give a toss about it.
No, because it doesn't fit. It's not about lust.
I learned quite rapidly to do what I was told to do and do it to the best of my ability and very convincingly, or I would suffer a brutal beating and some kind of sexual abuse as punishment for not doing it the way I was told to do it.
In your experience, is lust a male sin, do you think, rather than a female one?
No, so he just ignores it. It's quite shocking, actually.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised that the audience are probably stunned into silence, because they're not sure how to respond.
Yeah.
The job of a presenter of a programme is to set the tone and to sort of lead the audience through what they are hearing and perhaps sort of guide them into a response. Bernard is hopeless at that.
And what's also interesting and is also noticeable is that there's no interplay between the four guests. I don't think they hardly ever sort of interject with one another.
No.
They just basically kind of come on, do their bit, and then Bernard would go on to another guest to do a bit. And all by the end, all four are sitting together with Bernard, but they don't kind of talk to one another,
they might as well be in different studios. There's no interaction between them. And in fact, Bernard encourages that again because he turns his back on them.
Yeah.
He stands up, he towers over them.
Well, he kind of, at one point, Oliver Reed, I think we should say that, I think this is the first chapter in the sort of long-running 1980 saga of Oliver Reed goes on telly and is a bit drunk and makes an arse of himself.
I suppose the older you get, the more difficult it gets to actually remember Lust, really.
As for your memory, yes.
But I mean, as I said, Oliver Reed kind of comes on and is nominally sort of out of control. He won't let Bernard get a word in. But actually, he's really dull because he gets this piece of paper out of his pocket on which he's jotted down a definition of lust, which kind of goes from the Oxford Concise English Dictionary, which is not very concise at all.
Hang on a bit. For a bit, because I'm asking on script, and so I said lust.
I was
said,
just wondering when you were going to get on with it.
I said, what does lust mean?
And Bernard just sort of sits there looking at him.
My housekeeper, and it so happened that I got this thing and it's penned, I promise you, in my housekeeper's hand,
hoping that he would shut up.
What are we talking about here? Passion, lovely passion of life. Lust of life, lustful personality. Oh, my buckles, I love my old lady there, and I will lust after her, I will.
All Bernard could do is just kind of stand up in order to sort of dominate proceedings.
I must talk to Charlotte.
But Rolf Reed doesn't say anything that's very interesting, does he?
Well, it's a notable feature of a particular kind of drunk that you just become incredibly dull and boring.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Oliver, in the same way that he, everything about him is exaggerated, his dullness is exaggerated here, because he doesn't say anything is in even interesting, despite trying to act as if he is a bit ooh.
He's got this kind of vaguely fruity tone to his what
very
you say.
Ponderous way of speaking.
Yeah, which you kind of think this should be entertaining, but it's not really, is it?
But it's
terrible that Bernard just doesn't have the chops to kind of interrupt him or get him to shut up.
What's gone wrong here? Who's at fault? Bernard's obviously at fault for not being able to control him. But surely other people were responsible for contriving this situation in the first place.
Yeah, I think there's an issue of format here. The format is not robust enough so that when Linda Lovelace is talking about kind of, you know, being held at gunpoint in order to kind of, perform in those films, it's not robust enough to kind of deal with that.
You've got a collision, really, between a sort of, well, I guess, Saturday Night at the Mill.
Saturday Night at the Mill.
Style, very light-hearted.
Well, this is a show that wishes it was Saturday Night at the Mill.
And then something like, well, I don't think any other sort of programme is at the time, but it's something that in the 80s it would be something like After Dark.
Yeah. Good evening and welcome to After Dark, or as it was called in the Daily Mail's front page story this morning, Around Midnight.
Where you would have a very deliberate attempt at a cerebral
But After Dark was robust enough to deal with those issues, largely because there was no host,
audience either.
So they could just really do what they want, and if a theme developed or an interesting line of inquiry developed, they could deal with it and handle it. Whereas you get the notion that Bernard Falk is sitting there with the director kind of
shouting at him,
move it on.
It's aspiring to be a number of things and failing to be every single one of them.
Absolutely. Let's talk about one kind of key element in this show. I think that when they were making the show and planning the show, they kind of thought this is the revolutionary thing. This is our secret weapon. And what happens is that there are these comedy characters
sitting in the audience.
Yeah, they sort of interpose into the show as if they were real people. So at first we get Robbie Coltrane.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Bernie. Let's hear it for Bernard. No, that's fine. That's fine. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The one word I want to plant in your minds tonight is the word lust. And by that, I do not mean what you get in a Japanese car that has not been undersealed.
an unknown, I think, at this time, Robbie Coltrane. He's portraying this sort of slick, fast-talking American pop psychologist. And we're never quite sure whether the audience initially think he's a character or whether they think he's a real psychologist.
Yeah, and
it's very uneasy.
Because this is the very first segment of the show, it immediately establishes this slightly awkward air of thinking, well, hang on, no, is this for real? Yeah. Is it a spoof?
Yeah.
Or, hey, why don't we just loosen up a little here, right? I want everybody in the audience to turn to the person sitting on their left. Just turn to the person sitting on your left, please. Come on, come on, don't be shy, right? Turn to that person. Come on. Right? And I want you to undress that person with your eyes. Come on, just with your eyes, madam, please.
I think a lot of his patter is kind of not funny enough, and it sounds just like the sort of thing that a real kind of pop psychologist would say. So it's a kind of uneasy air hanging over the audience.
Yes.
And that's the first item in the entire series.
I know. And then the other character is a woman.
Are you aware that rather than provoke lust, among women, you provoked a considerable amount of anger?
Hold still! Hold up! I've had enough of this. Mr. Falk, sit down immediately. Bring this camera over here. What is going on here? Ladies and gentlemen, listen to me. Listen to the voice of sanity for a change.
Yes. She's a puritanical South African character.
Campaigning.
Yeah.
A woman who's sort of on a sort of slightly Mary Whitehouse-y.
Well, I think I might have just worked because she was called
Mitzi Wildebeest.
So think that's meant to sound like in a South African version of Mary Whitehouse? But she interrupts a conversation that Bernard's having with Erica Rowe, the streaker.
It's been set up that she will do it at a certain point.
And then she delivers her monologue. And then after 2 or 3 minutes of the monologue, then the rock band who have been hired to kind of add a bit of excitement to the show. They kind of sort of stride on, cutting her off.
Mitzi, she said, don't bend down in front of the little boys, especially the little black ones, or they will never respect you after what they've seen. Now, and this is exactly what I'm talking about! Don't you see this?
So for a few minutes, it has the feel of a kind of slightly anarchic.
It's happening, isn't it?
A happening is underway,
and they're trying to give the impression that nobody's in control and kind of anything goes. And I think the notion of anything goes on television is a kind of seductive notion, but actually it doesn't work.
Never works.
It doesn't work. There's another segment of the show where Bernard is kind of interrogating the audience. He keeps asking them.
He's roving. He's roving around the studio.
And he keeps asking them, what's your definition of lust? And at one point, he kind of accosts these three bathing beauties, as he calls them.
How do you define lust? Presumably you haven't experienced it.
No, it's complete silence.
I know, and at one point one of them says,
actually, I'm not a professional, no beauty queens. I've only been in for two, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, never mind, I'll just be content to lust with you.
You would have thought that the production team would have primed people to be in the audience for Bernard to
absolutely,
talk to.
Absolutely, yes.
But plainly that's not happened. He's left with egg on his face and just have to walk and...
It takes on a rather despondent air as he sort of meanders around the studio.
He's basically wandering around looking for someone.
Looking at anyone he can find who can answer this question.
Who else is there?
There is a man who's dressed in quite sort of in a sort of outre fashion.
He is.
With snazzy sunglasses.
They're sort of yellow goggles and he's wearing...
He hasn't got socks. He's wearing shoes but no socks.
Yeah.
Black tight jeans.
Yeah.
And obviously Bernard is expecting a rather dangerous response.
But,
and I suppose that I've got to ask you, really, how you provoke lust in people whom you doubtless provoke it in.
Well, I just do it, you know. I just let it happen. I quite like
just let it hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not literally, I didn't mean that.
No, but I just I quite enjoy it, you know. It's quite a nice thing. You know?
Indeed. Thank you very much.
He's just got nothing to say.
Another one who has nothing to say.
There's a woman who works as a topless fire eater.
That's yes. And, yes. Again, she has nothing to say.
No.
Well, fire eating is a very dangerous profession. Although I have perfected it over a time, you know.
There's a male stripper.
You must see lust at first hand, mustn't you? I mean,
I don't know what lust is for a start.
Yeah,
so.
You have a clue.
Yeah, he again. It becomes abandoned. Everyone who Bernard answers,
yeah,
the person in the audience immediately shoots Bernard down and says, "No, you're wrong."
Yeah.
Or implies that the question is somehow insubstantial.
And then there are representatives of the Salvation Army, but they've got things to say about lust, but they're kind of incredibly predictable things. You know what the people from the Salvation Army are going to say about lust.
Gentlemen, ladies, and the members of the Salvation Army, welcome. Is there room for lust in a Christian marriage?
No, there's no room at all, I say, Bernard, to this.
Yes, they are the ones who have, who are the most articulate,
yeah.
who are the
yeah.
most willing to engage with Bernard. There's
yeah.
a whole row of them.
Yeah.
We only really hear
yeah.
from a very forthright man.
Yeah.
But Bernard asks some rather indiscreet questions
oh,
of him.
Oh, yeah, I know.
But what arouses you about, are you married?
Oh, yes.
What arouses so. You about your wife?
I just want to read something about Bernard Falk, which Julian Barnes, who was the Observer's TV critic at the time, he spent quite a bit of August 1982 writing about Sin on Saturday.
Well, you could blame him.
So he said, "It may just be a run of good luck, but I haven't spotted Bernard Falk on the box for some months. Not since Newsnight maliciously dispatched him to Chateau Margaux. There, Falk treated baffled local viniculturalists to his interesting view that all wine is plonk, and that expensive claret is a big froggy con. Falk's style is one of perky inoffensiveness. He seems to quite understand, if you find it as surprising as he does, that here he is on the telly. You half expect him to have a big cardboard sign round his neck saying, 'Hello, Mum.'" Do you think that... I think that kind of basically sums up Bernard Falk's whole television personality.
Well, he's fine. He did a good job on Now Get Out of That when he was sitting in his little room...
With a script.
With this monitor. And so all he had to do was just link between footage.
Yeah.
He wasn't out on location, was he?
Yeah.
Whereas here, he's in an environment that is totally unsympathetic towards him. Do you think it might be... Or it might have worked better... as an ITV programme? I'm thinking particularly of an LWT programme.
I think if it had been an LWT programme, it would have been kind of slightly more metropolitan. It would have been slightly a bit more kind of sophisticated. It would have been a bit more kind of adult in a kind of
Well, I'm thinking of
sense.
Someone like Michael Aspel might have been able to helm it, but done it in tandem with someone like Janet Street Porter, who could have...
I'm liking this suggestion.
Who could have taken care of the more sort of earthy stuff?
Yeah, I think so. Bernard Falk is very much at sea with the earthy stuff, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. It's painful to watch.
So we need to talk about the fate of Sin on Saturday. Its life was a short, eventful one, wasn't it?
Well, I'm still struck by the fact that not only was the programme given... a second chance in the second episode, but then it was given another chance as well. So because it ran to what three?
Well,
is that right?
Isn't that just kind of they're trying to avoid embarrassment? I think kind of they probably knew after the first episode that the whole thing, you know, was doomed to failure. But kind of
they stuck with it.
Well, the second one was covetousness.
Now, see, I think there's a problem there before you even begin, because I think most people don't even know what covetousness is.
Ian, what's your definition of covetousness?
Who was on hand to help us?
Well, unfortunately, the Radio Times billings don't say who's on second edition. They do say who's on the third edition, the third and final edition, as it turned out. So the topic was envy. So they did covetousness and envy in consecutive weeks.
Oh, God.
And the guests on that edition were Alan Wicker, the Duke of Argyll, and Willie Hamilton MP, the famous anti-monarchist campaigner.
So there was a fourth one, I guess, that was billed but was never shown.
Yeah, and it was going to be about gluttony with bounty hunter Tiny Boyles.
I can't believe that was his real name.
Fanny Craddock, George Best, and chef d'oeuvre Patrick Barlow.
Okay, well, we've just watched an episode of Call My Bluff and an episode of Sin on Saturday. Now we come to the key question.
I think I can predict your answer, but of those two shows, Ian, which one would you be happy to watch again?
Well, I would certainly be happy to watch Call My Bluff around the clock, were it the alternative to seeing even 1 minute more.
Well,
I've seen on Saturday, although perhaps a part of me, a small part of me, would be intrigued to see maybe a snippet of that third and final one, just to see if it was in any way an improvement.
I think we can be pretty sure it wasn't an improvement.
Well, in which case I'm happy to spare myself that. I take it you would agree.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I mean, Call My Bluff, it was middle-aged, it was middle-class, it was middle-brow, but it was really entertaining. So, Ian, what's your definition of lust?
You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched an episode of Call My Bluff, first shown on the 9th of May 1983,
and Sin on Saturday from the 7th of August 1982.
Goodbye.